Is the learning in your school competency-based? Is it personalized? Is it happening anytime, anywhere? Is it student-owned? In other words, is the learning student-centered? And are all students learning more deeply, more equitably, and becoming career and college ready? If you have these questions, want to know what the research says about them, and are trying to figure out how to implement these ideas in your classrooms and schools, you've come to the right place. Thank you for listening to the Student-Centered Learning Podcast. I'm your host, Arthur Barriff, and I've been a principal and teacher in student-centered schools for over 17 years, and I can't wait to share a story or interview that will help you help your students. Today we continue a series of very special episodes, 15 interviews of student-centered educators brought to us by guest producers. You're about to hear from Edmicelli Xavier, a Spanish teacher at Paul Cuffey Upper School, charter school in Providence, Rhode Island. Edmicelli grew up in Providence and is a product of the underfunded and underperforming inner-city schools. Now she is earning a Master's of Education in Urban Teaching at Providence College this month. She interviews Keith Morton, public and community service professor at Providence College, who has particular interests in community building, nonviolence, and youth development. Edmicelli and Keith have a broad conversation about student-centered learning, the power of it, how to do it, and what systems and structures need to change to enable it. Enjoy.
Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning into my podcast. I am Edmicelli, and I am here with Keith. Keith, thank you so much for being with us today.
Glad to be here.
So I will just start off by, getting right to it and just asking you to let us know what you would define student-centered learning as, in your own words.
Yeah, I think it's really a philosophy of relationship between the teacher or mentor, guide, and the student or apprentice, and not so much a set of methods or practices. And the way I imagine it is that it means that you take the time as the educator to pay attention to the person that you're educating, and that you shape the situation that you're creating for them to learn based on who they are, what's going on with them, what they need to make the next step or develop, to figure out what that step is for themselves. So it's kind of the other end of the spectrum from a one-size-fits-all. But I also don't think it means that it has to take a particular form. You know, there are some students that lectures are really, or some moments where lectures are a really good learning tool. Other times when a real hands-on experimental approach to something is the best option. So I don't think it's a technique as much as a philosophy.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I'm glad you mentioned that about the one-size-fits-all, because it's true, there are some students that do benefit better from those lectures, those traditional type of instructions. So I think that has been my biggest challenge in the classroom, where how do I help every student? How do I, like you said, get to know each student? Because I don't have, it's not a one-on-one in the classroom with just one student and one teacher. At times there's 28 students, 15 students.
A little overwhelming.
Right, for 50 minutes. Mm-hmm. So how can one make sure to both make sure that the content is being delivered and is being taught, but at the same time, like you mentioned, I'm getting that one-on-one with 28 students in 50 minutes. Is that even possible? Yeah. Or is that not really part of student-centered learning to just get it all in just one 50-minute block?
Right. So I think you're asking a question that's really about a set of structural or systemic problems that trying to practice this philosophy of student-centered learning in a system or an institution that really isn't organized to make it possible is really frustrating.
Okay.
And I think can end up confusing the teacher, diminishing morale, and also confusing the students. But I think some of the systemic issues that it points to is, why do we have things organized in 50-minute blocks? Why do we put the teacher in charge and in control? Why is so much of the relationship between the teacher and the student about making students learn, which right out of the gate is an adversarial relationship, rather than thinking about we're going to commit 6 hours a day, 4, 5, 6 days a week to the learning process, and asking the students, so what would you like to do with that? You know, as the older person with more experience and wisdom, or bringing in some of that wisdom from the community, like a geographic community or a community of practice, there's some things you really need to know if you're going to pursue the path you want to pursue. So let's get connected to that. And then let's figure out how to create an environment in which the learning that you want to have happen for you happens naturally. Right. So if it's learning Spanish, yeah, there's value, I think, in having a teacher formally say, these are the rules of grammar, here's a vocabulary list you might want to think about starting with. But imagine if a student's also doing an internship, especially as a non-Spanish speaker, in an environment where the first language is Spanish. Like, it's a mini immersion experience for a few hours every day, or, you know, 10 hours a week or something. Like, that's pretty powerful. My own experience, I had a pretty lousy experience on the whole K-12. Partly my fault for being a pretty resistant student often. A lot of different reasons kind of inform that. And the few times I had a teacher, maybe twice in elementary school, pretty much never in high school. High school was a little easier to negotiate, but, you know, just those two teachers really saw me. And even in a kind of blocked class schedule, they still were able to adapt the expectations that I had to fulfill in order to give me more of what I wanted to do, what I was good at, made me a better community member. And I really look back at that as with a lot of appreciation. I had some behavioral issues, I guess you would call them these days, in school. There are two classes I never got in any trouble. I was like a model community member, and it was because they saw me. Right. You know, and I felt like, yeah, this isn't perfect, but we're in it together. Like, you know, you like me. Right. And I think a lot of times what we forget in these institutions that we've created that are have this kind of low-grade adversarial relationship built in, the assumption that students need to be pushed to learn, that they have to be made to be there, we kind of forget how much it matters that they believe that their teacher likes them.
Yes.
You know, and it, I mean, not like we're best buddies, we're going to go hang out, I'm just going to let you do anything you want, but like, I see you, care about you, I'm down for you, and I'm going to call you out when you need to be called out, but the end of the day, your life is your own life,
right.
And I like you. Like, right. And I like it. I like what you're trying to do with yourself.
Yeah.
And I think that care and respect just creates an environment, even if the environment isn't perfect, where you're in it, you're working together. Yeah. So that's a long answer to your question.
No.
But,
and I know a little bit about you and your history, and I believe one of the classes that you were mentioning was it fifth grade, I believe, where you were allowed to just
fourth grade.
Can you tell us more about that? And it's funny because I think that teacher, though it was long ago, was implementing a student-centered learning environment, and maybe that wasn't even part of...
no language for
exactly.
It. Yeah, it
wasn't exactly.
Like, her name was Mrs. Baugh, B-A-U-G-H, if she's out there, just a shout-out. she'd be an older woman at this point. Hopefully she's still around. Yeah, she taught fourth grade. It was in an American school in Naples, Italy, for the children of military personnel mostly, which was me. And very early in the semester, I was kind of being a knucklehead, just disrespectful, disruptive. And she cornered me on the way out to recess one day and said, you know, two ways to do things, my way. Which means you could be president of the United States or you're going to go to jail. Which one do you want? And it was one right answer. And then she said, and what I want is for you to be happy in my class. So if we're going to work together, you have to tell me what works for you. And she really meant it. And even though she was a little scary at the time, like, I decided to trust her. Like, she was real about it. And so we talked about what would work. I ended up with a library card that allowed me to check as many books as I wanted to out of the school library every day if I wished. I didn't have to wait to go down with a class or anything. And I would go down every day and get out two or three books, like big, you know, adult books in fourth grade. And I'd sit in the back of the classroom and I read books.
Right.
And I had to tell her what I was reading and occasionally write something about them. And then when tests came up in other subjects, I had to take the tests and perform at whatever the expectations were. But as long as I kind of behaved, I got to do what I loved most, which was sit in the back and be left alone,
right.
Kind of space to breathe, kind of decompress, but also, like, I loved to read. And that was just an enormous gift from her. And what was remarkable is that she did it with all the students in class, because we had one of those big classes, you know, 24, 25 students. Right. And everybody felt like, yeah, you know, I'm, like, she likes me. Like,
right.
She's going to do what she needs to. And none of us, you know, a lot of the objection a lot of times that I hear these days from in any institution, but particularly in schools as well, if I do it for this student, it's not fair to the other students. And instead, what happened in this classroom was that everybody recognized that each of us needed something different. And there wasn't jealousy of you got something special and I didn't, because everybody had, under the circumstances, what could work best for them. And you know, it just really made a really, really strong impression on me. Obviously, I'm 60 years old and still talking about it.
Yeah.
And still spent a lot of time thinking about what is it that she did that worked, and how do we institutionalize that? How do we capture it? You know, 'cause she was also a serious teacher. You know,
right.
She wasn't just nice to us. One of the things that struck me about her background, looking back, this came up for other reasons in the classroom, is that she, while she had a master's degree, I believe, in education, so she was a very, very smart woman, like a real intellectual, which, you know, was also a gift of another kind. And but she had worked her way through graduate school and working in a lockdown psychiatric ward. And a lot of the methods that she had learned for managing people who were struggling came out of that environment. So she kind of knew how to recognize when somebody was having a bad day.
Right.
And she had some tools to work with in responding. She understood the value of creating a community of support for people, so that, you know, that there was peer education happening in our classroom.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of looking out for each other. And she believed at the end of the day that everybody wanted to do well. People
right.
wanted to be good, they wanted to be healthy, they wanted things to work. And she viewed the problems as they came up, not as evidence that she needed more control, but as evidence that it was hard. And you kind of dealt with it and moved on, but you kept the basic idea of everybody's in this trying to make something good happen.
Right.
And that was what created such a positive environment. But I really think that, looking back on it, that her knowledge of sort of human development and when humans are not doing well, the mm-hmm. effects of stress and trauma really, really informed what she did.
Right. So. And it seems like she gave you that choice, right? It wasn't mm-hmm. like, this is, all right, listen, if you continue down this path, you're going to be in jail. She kind of gave you two choices of what could happen in
mm-hmm.
your life. One of them being able to see your potential.
Yep.
And gave you the choice, right,
yeah.
of what is it that you want to do with it. And I think that's yeah. so powerful, and I
yeah,
think that's
yeah,
probably what changed
right.
your
yeah.
mind.
Yeah, she was really the first teacher, I think it's fair to say, the first teacher I had who said, yeah, you're okay, like,
right.
I like you, you're a smart guy, you can do this if you want to. Until then, it was all teachers trying to make me do things,
mm-hmm.
like the comment on the report cards for years was not living up to his potential.
Mm.
So, like, you know, how does a child hear that? You know, like, if he finally got serious, he'd be a good student, but he's just kind of a screw-up,
right.
you know, and he's whatever. And I would think to myself, I'm doing the best I can do, like, you know, and you don't like me, and every time you do something, me knowing you don't like me, I feel it as an attack. And where I come from,
mm.
somebody attacks me, it's like, I'm going to shut this down. If I'd rather get in trouble and shut it down than be attacked,
yeah.
you know, so... And I don't know, I mean, I wasn't conscious of that, but that was really the behavioral pattern.
Right.
And so for her to say, you know, you've got some potential, and she did it with humor, like, you know, she didn't say you're going to go to jail like this big heavy threat. It was like,
right.
you know you're screwing up. Like,
right.
we both know you're screwing up, and we also know it's no fun.
Right.
So, like, make a smart choice. Here's how.
Right.
You know. So in addition to giving me the choice, she also gave me a pathway to do it.
Yes.
Like, it was concrete and real.
Right. Yeah. And it's so great that you said that you weren't conscious about it, right? And I think that's what happens in our classrooms a lot of the times, that if anyone should be conscious about it, it should be the adults, right? Because these students, whether K through 12, they're going through these transitions. They don't even know who they are. Mm-hmm. And they react in certain ways just because that's how their mind is set up. That's, yeah. you know, the defense mechanism that they have. They see something or they hear someone hurting them or their peers, automatically that wall just goes up without them even realizing it.
Right. You and see it's normal.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So for a teacher to have that control of being conscious and saying there's more than what's mm-hmm. what I'm seeing right now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's a relationship and a partnership. Like, you know, if you see a friend of yours struggling like that, you ask them, like, what's going on? Is, like, anything I can do?
Right.
And sometimes, most of the time, they say no. Like, I'm just leave me alone for a little while. Right. And every once in a while, they say, yeah, I need you to do this.
Right.
And then if you're a real friend, you do it.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, in some ways, it's not more complicated than that. The other thing I think that really matters that I was responding to is at the same time that I was, you know, not doing great in school or, you know, not living up to my potential, I actually really, really wanted to do that. But I felt like the path was shut off to me. And the evidence that I continued to believe was meaningful all the way through high school was that there were always, out of your 25 kids in your classroom, there were the 5 kids who the teacher liked, and they were the good students. Like, they sat at the front, and they got A's, and, you know. And that was, like, a code I did not know how to crack. I actually wasn't very interested in it. Like, I thought they were kind of boring and, you know, like, dutiful, but not very creative. Like, I had, not fair to them, but and so, you know, the other part about student-centered learning is there are 100 ways to be successful. You got 25 kids in class, there are 25 forms of success.
Right.
And it's not that you have lesser standards or lesser expectations. It's just that the evidence of learning and the meaning of what has been learned is different for every student. And they get to say, here's what I learned and here's why it's important to me.
Right.
And you as the teacher say, good for you.
Right.
You know, I'm so excited.
Right. Yeah. That's a great way of wrapping it up. I was going to ask you to just summarize what we just discussed and what that looks like in a classroom, but I think that's a great way of doing it. There are, if there's 25 students, there are 25 different strategies because everyone is an individual. Mm-hmm. And just being able to look at them, and I think that's really the key, right? Looking at them, seeing them for who they are, mm-hmm. as opposed to what this book that I read about child psychology.
Kind of
exactly.
Yeah, and who they are in addition to the 50 minutes a day that you have.
That you have them.
You know, and that's asking, because of the systemic issues, the institutional structures, that's asking most of the time too much of teachers.
Yes.
Because it's not only you have one class for 50 minutes, you've
right.
got 5 classes for 50 minutes.
Right.
You know, with, like, how do you, none of us can do those real human relationships with 250 kids,
right.
like, or people, you know, it's just
yeah.
50, you've got a fighting chance, 25,
yeah.
you can do it.
Right.
But it's really hard.
Right. Well, thank you so much. And if you don't mind, do you have any resources that you can provide to our readers so that they can be as woke as you are regarding?
Well, thank you for that. And do I have resources? I love resources. So it kind of depends where people want to jump in. I don't think there's a particular formula for getting introduced to this kind of thinking. And I, when you told me you might ask this question, Ed Miceli, I kind of broke it down into 3 pieces. So I'm going to give you a couple of resources, if that's all right.
Of course, thank
One
you.
One was, I think, particularly for people working inside mainstream institutions of education, it's helpful to imagine what the radical edge could look like. Like, if we did things the most different from where we are now, what would it look like? And a movement that I've been in love with for years is described in Grace Llewellyn's book, The Teenage Liberation Handbook, How to Quit School and Get a Real Life in Education. And it's the book that is one of the centerpieces for the unschooling movement. So there's a group of people who believe that schools as institutions, not as teachers, but as institutions, do so much damage that most kids would be better off learning on their own,
right,
because of they want to learn, they learn naturally, time is organized differently, relationships with adults are different, but they all get there. Everybody crosses the finish line, you know, by the time they're an appropriate age, you know, in their late teens, early 20s. I also think that there's a real value in starting to think about the social context, ideological foundation for making a case for kind of a liberatory education or a student-centered education. And the people I think of for that, you know, Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed is kind of the starting point.
Right.
It's a book, it's a problematic book in some ways, as well as really, really useful. And somebody he inspired is Bell Hooks, and I think of her, and she's got Teaching to Transgress, which a lot of people know. But actually my favorite is Teaching Community, A Pedagogy of Hope, which really, like, if Mrs. Baugh could have written a book in fourth grade, like, it would have been, you know, Teaching Community. Like,
right.
She just captured that spirit, and it's a really beautiful articulation of that. I also think for a harder-hitting, much more critical perspective, I think of Henri Giraud and almost anything he wrote. My particular go-to is he wrote Youth in a Suspect Society in 2009. And he basically, through a lot of his writing, describes the ways in which we talk a very sentimental game about caring for young people and then really exert systems of command and control over their lives that are very, very damaging. And we do it unconsciously most of the time. And Youth in a Suspect Society is a one articulation of that. Then, often what teachers want is sort of that, so how do I do this?
Right.
You know, like the method, like tell me what I do in my classroom with, you know, this student. And I think some of the places to start with that, anything by John Dewey, Kurt Lewin, David Kolb, they're all about foundations of experiential learning, which are all relational learning as well. But I also think Janet Eiler, it's E-Y-L-E-R, she has a really, really useful brief essay on the website of the American Association of Colleges and Universities. The title of it is The Power of Experiential Education, and it's really an articulation of this philosophy, this relational philosophy of learning. Another place that probably has come up in some of your other research is Dennis Littke and Samantha Gravel's The Big Picture, Education is Everyone's Business. It's really about big picture company, Met High School, College Unbound, prison education program, and how to create an institution that kind of works along the philosophy that we've been talking about. And then the last one that is a little more theoretical, Max von Manin's Researching Everyday Experience, Researching Lived Experience. You know, it's just learn how to reflect.
Yeah.
So that would be my go-to list.
Great. Thank you. And obviously, I always enjoy speaking with you. Thank you so much for speaking to our listeners and for providing those great resources.
Right? Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you again for listening to the Student-Centered Learning Podcast. Let us know what you think about this episode or what you tried in your school by commenting on our Facebook page. You can also subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher, and please leave a rating so others can find us. You can also follow us on Twitter at STUCNTRPodcast. And remember, students learn deeply when they are at the center.